Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 124 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me, surprisingly, at the end of this season is a brand new guest, someone who's never been on any of my episodes before, any seasons. Hopefully, he will... do well here and, want to come back in future seasons. Who knows? My guest is Eric Paul, the host of the Everything is Primary Source podcast. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here. I feel like this has been a long time coming because I've been following your show and following you on social media and enjoying what you do. I love the concept of analyzing a movie minute to minute. I think it's just a brilliant thing. And that's actually where I got started podcasting, listening to Star Wars.
That's what happened to all of us.
Being inspired by the breakdown that those guys. Yeah. And I was just like, this is incredible. And, you know, the kind of conversations you can get out of just 1 minute of film time, and they go all the way to the end credits as well. So
yeah, my problem is I'm a completionist. I have to do everything. I can't skip. There are people who don't do credits, and I just don't understand why. And sometimes I feel that episodes where I do credits are even more interesting than some of the other episodes, you know, during the regular season. You know, I don't feel that you know, the credit episodes are wasted episodes, you know, just adding on or something like that, because you can always find something very, very interesting about the various people listed or whatever. But we'll get to that over the course of the next few days. We'll see how that all plays out. So minute 124 begins with the continuation of the cast credits and ends with the second unit director credit. So Eric, why don't you first tell people, like, what's your background with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? Do you remember? I mean, is it among your favorite movies? Is it not? You know, like, just whatever you want to tell us about it.
It is. I think it kind of reminds me of how I watched a few of the other movies in this genre of action, in adventure movies of the 90s, where I started with a sequel and then worked my way backwards. So I saw, because in 1995, 96, we had HBO, Showtime at home, and this would be on. And I would watch it, and I loved it. I thought it was such, I liked, it had some elements I always like in movies, including, and I know all the Die Hard movies follow this, but, you know, a very finite time period. I love that. I loved that it was, for some reason, I like stories that they go back and forth a lot. Like, they cover a lot of geography, but they end up back where they started in some cases. Had that element. I love Samuel L. Jackson. I thought his addition to the cast was great. So I start Die Hard with a Vengeance and then kind of work my way backwards to the Die Hard trilogy. And did the same thing with Terminator. Terminator 2 was the first of the entries I saw with that, and then saw the first one. Did the same thing with Alien. I saw Alien 3 first, all around the same time period. Like,
yeah, Alien 3 came out in 1992.
I worked my way back way from that. And so this movie, it seems to, for me, it seems to follow a pattern where, like, I enter story a little bit late. It shows how good this movie is, that you can watch it as a standalone movie. You don't need to have all of the background of the original two. And that's why when I saw that you were doing Die Hard with a Vengeance by the minute, I'm like, I'd love to be a part of that, because this movie is one of my favorites of it's my favorite of the Die Hard movies, but it's also one of my favorites of the action genre.
Right. Okay. I mean, I think part of the reason why this movie works well on its own is because, I mean, as we've talked about many different times, this movie was originally, you know, written as a standalone movie. It wasn't connected to John McClane or anything like that. The fact that they were able to, sew it together and make it part of of the Die Hard franchise is great. You know, even though we've talked about it over the last 123 episodes, you know, that there are things that feel as if they're too attached. You know, they're like hanging, they're hanging chads, you know, to use a political connotation to the whole thing. It's something that works but doesn't 100% work. And I think that also partly has to do with the fact that, you know, the trouble that they had figuring out a good ending for this movie. You know, we've talked about the fact that the original script wasn't used, and then they had the alternate ending that they also didn't like, and then they chose the ending, you know, that we just talked about just a few days ago. To me, it doesn't work. That's my to me the biggest fault of this movie is the ending. The ending is not as satisfying because it feels tacked on.
And it's completely, you know, I keep going back to geography, but it's so far away from where all the action was for the first part of the movie. And then to extract the characters and just throw them into, you know, Quebec, it just seems kind of, I agree with you. It's the one, and it's too bad that that's the way the movie ends, is having a stumble like that.
Yeah, exactly. I again, it's that's why this isn't as high when I rank these three movies. You know, the Die Hard trilogy. Not talking about the other ones afterwards. You know, just if you look at the Die Hard trilogy, to me, this is the weakest of the three. I know a lot of people out there are screaming at their iPods right now, saying, "What? What are you talking about?" Whatever. But the bottom line is that for me, the problem here. I mean, I love this movie. I think it's great. You know, I'm not belittling it at all, but the ending just isn't satisfying like the other two. The other two have much better endings, and you know, this, like I said, this one feels like they said, okay, well, we just gotta find something else, and it doesn't work as well. But oh well, what can you do about it? Let's put it this way, it's still better than four and five. So
Yes, I don't even really consider those as part of, obviously they can't be part of a trilogy by definition, but
correct.
those ones really are disappointments.
Yes, five is. I actually, a little bit behind the curtain here. This week, I actually just rewatched both four and five. Four, I thought was pretty good. You know, it has its moments. And five, I was, I think even less of it now than I did the other four times that I saw it. You know, each time I see five, it's just less and less. The last time I saw it was 2 years ago, and now I just watched it, and I was like, it was agonizing to watching five.
Right. And it's I went to that movie. I saw it in the theater because of how much I like Die Hard with a Vengeance. I'm like, oh, this looks kind of similar, you know, citywide, you know, going around, actually even further than just one city. I mean, just that whole dynamic of it. And then while I was in the theater, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I wasted my money on this one. I haven't revisited it at all
Right. I
since
got to tell
then.
you that five is the only one I actually have not seen in the theater. So, you know, and I'm obviously not upset about that fact. All right. So here we are at the end of the list of the cast, right, within the credits. And, you know, a lot of these people that are listed here are people that we talked about over the course of the movie. You know, I always like to point out, you know, the different character actors along the way and stuff like that. And I mean, the one name that always stands out for me here, and it's very hard to try and identify him. And you know, even when I think about it now, I can't remember where we see him. Is you have the list of listing of someone who's a fisherman, and it says John McTiernan Senior. Okay, which obviously we all know who that is. It's you know, the director John McTiernan's father. But I don't recall seeing a fisherman in the movie, especially not one with any bit of dialogue.
I wonder if it was a cut scene and they just felt
Right.
that they had to keep him in the credits because of the relationship with the director. But yeah, that I mean, I guess if, you know, maybe one of the scenes close to the water, you see somebody in the background, or, you know, I don't know.
Right. I mean, it's pretty funny because, I mean,
It could be
when
him.
he did Die Hard 2, so, you know, there is Bruce Willis's father has a small little role in there. You know, he's actually the tow truck driver at the beginning. So, you know, when you have, and he has a line of dialogue, you know, saying, "All right, Murray, you can take it away," or something like that. Or maybe he's supposed
Right.
to be Murray. I'm trying to remember at this point what it was. But the bottom line is that I've not been able to identify him in this movie. And, you know, there's nothing that even helps. You know, IMDb does not help here. You know, John McTiernan Sr., the only thing I was able to find is that he was in four of his son's movies. You know, little bit parts in all of them. Which again, it
Kind of like a Clint Howard being in
no,
Ron
but Clint
Howard's,
Howard actually gets things to do, and they give him good roles. Yeah,
dialogue, yeah.
he's not a fisherman in the
Right.
background.
Right. Well, fittingly, in Splash, he has the tiniest role in that, but he's still in it, and he says a line. He's like, "Oh, excuse me," or something like that. But yeah, he's not the fisherman in Cape Cod. Just the credits in general. And definitely by 1995, this is the greatest ex of filmmaking, the rules of Hollywood on display, where you can't just I mean, you watch an evolution of the way that movies are credited and people that take part in movies are credited from the beginning of Hollywood, where it's usually very simple, maybe four or five cards at the front of the movie and then one or two at the end that showed the major players and the director and who wrote it and things like that. By the time we're in the 90s, we're talking every single person that had anything remotely to do with it. And my assumption, like you were saying before, is that in order to be listed as a credited cast member, you probably have a line in the movie. So I don't know if maybe this is director, just kind of, because it's his dad, he just, put those rules aside and said, I know that you were a background guy or you're a fisherman who's, getting home. Maybe he's on the subway or
You see a
something.
guy
He's, you know,
with a
went
box of
fishing and he's
tackle,
heading home for the,
standing on the subway. Yeah, there you
right. In the background as, as it's, barreling towards him. That might be just him, trying to keep a trend going of having his dad and or having a family member of the cast in the movie. I think it's within the minute that we have is James Sato, Sato,
He's
is he
listed here.
listed as Korean?
I actually talked about him.
And he's the Shredder.
I actually know him also from we talked about this in during the scenes. He's the deli proprietor, and he's running after the two kids, you know, who've stolen the
Yeah.
stuff. And so he was on a TV show that I really, really used to enjoy. It was only on for one season. It was called Eli Stone, where he played like the mentor of the main character. So I've always, you know, known who he is. And when I was doing this and I saw it, I was like, wow, you know, it really shocked me.
He plays a lot of, now that he's a bit older, he plays a lot of very calm, cool, collected, mentor, teacher type characters. Between Die Hard with a Vengeance and then I think of course, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, he plays Shredder. It's such a different take on the guy. I follow him on
Oh, wow.
Instagram because I have a bit of a local connection to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm a teacher and I teach in the same city in New Hampshire that they were invented.
Oh, wow.
So the Ninja Turtles came from Dover, New Hampshire. Just like Die Hard with a Vengeance, they take place in New York City. So it's one of those kind of things. But he will routinely on Instagram post things about his time as the Shredder. And but yeah, it's when you see somebody like that who has built somewhat of a career since then, in the kind of lost at the end of the credits, it's and I did a similar search for a few of the other names I saw in there, just kind of out of curiosity, like did they because this movie is almost 30 years old. So has their career taken off since then? Have they been in other stuff? And nothing really jumped out. Was there any other names that jumped off from the screen?
Well, the only, again, we talked about it during the course of the movie, but the cab driver that John steals the cab from before driving through Central Park is played by Asif Manvi, who is a comedian, and he was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He was for many years. So he's someone that I've seen, you know. But there's really no one else. The only other person that stands up that I saw, Rob Sedgwick, who's Kira Sedgwick's brother.
Okay,
Kevin Bacon's brother-in-law. You know, he plays one of the cops, one of the fake cops that Zeus brings the. The bomb.
Thank you, sir. They're extra.
Exactly.
Going overboard with their Americanism.
Exactly. There. Yeah, but there's no one else that really jumps out. I mean, again, that's one of the reasons why I love watching movies from the 80s and 90s. There's a lot of times that you'll see people that you clearly recognize from other movies just in the background.
Right.
You know, that type of thing. And you're like, oh my God, you know, like, I didn't know that you know, I didn't recognize the person at the time because I didn't know who they are. You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's his name? Paul Giamatti is in Saving Private Ryan. You know, it's like, huh?
That's right. Yeah, he's a very, very, very bit part.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder how, and I was actually just talking about this with my wife the other day, how, especially in the TV world, not so much in movies, but TV in particular, where there's certain actors that seems to have built an entire career just kind of rotating through, cycling through the TV sitcom circuit, right? Like they might play a character on one or two episodes of a show and then move on to the next one. But as viewers, we get to see them, especially in this streaming age that we're in, we get to see them like, oh, there's that guy again. And you start making these connections in your head. And it seems like certain shows or at least certain networks, and in the case of movies, certain studios are almost like hubs for them, that they're always being called back to their mothership, and then they go back out again and hit a few other things. And you know, like I think about like Frasier, the TV show Frasier seems to be one of those shows where not only is there a lot of recognizable faces, people that have been in other movies and TV shows and such, but then you'll see them paired up again on other programs. And I can only assume it has something to do with the casting director and, you know, whoever's in charge of putting together, you know, a cast of, you know, some of the smaller supporting roles of, oh yeah, I know this guy, I worked with him on, you know, this other show, we could probably get him in, you know, I think he's not busy for a week or whatever. And it really shows, just like the rest of the credits, it shows the more working side of Hollywood, not just the glamorous superstar side of Hollywood, but the actual people who, you know, it's their job. Like this is them making a living, and they don't live in a gigantic Beverly Hills mansion. They, you know, they might not even live directly in LA. They, you know, they just, that's how they make enough money to put food on the table.
I think part of it also is, I mean, back in the 30s, 40s and 50s, you know, you had all these bit part actors that were part of the studio, and those are people that were showing up in every movie from that studio and stuff like that. So that was very prevalent then. And then, you know, in the 70s, like you said, a lot of people started showing up on TV shows, and they jump around from TV shows and stuff like that. And then in the 80s and 90s, it was the same thing. You know, you had just different people that would constantly show up. Now, you mentioned Frasier before. One of the things I always loved about Frasier is that Frasier were always famous people. You know, they got like recognizable actors to play to do those voice roles, and I believe at the end of every season, you know, they gave like a big thank you to all the different people who contributed, you know, like thank you for all the call the celebrity callers,
right? Yeah, thanks for calling, and yeah, you're absolutely. I mean, because they, speaking of credits, at the end of, and that's why I love watching credits and movies and TV shows, is because, you know, especially in the pre-IMDb age where you could just look everything up, it would confirm your suspicions of like, I know that person, I've seen him before, what's his name, or if you're trying to recognize just the voice on the phone on Frasier, Oh, that okay. And then, at the very end, they'll give the credit. But you're right, at the end of every season, they would give their headshots, and be like, thanks for calling. And, it's like Margo Kidder, the kid who played Elliot in E.T., all the different actors who provided, their voices and so forth. So credits tell a story. They're not. It actually kind of drives me crazy on streaming when the credits start and not even 10 seconds into them, the
Then so
service is
then
trying to get me to
it
move,
blocks it.
next show starting in, or next movie starts in, and or if you're watching on television, they'll put the credits on like hyperspeed. And there's no way you could possibly read it. It's like a tiny corner in the bottom, coming up next. And, it's like, okay, well, so all that person's, blood, sweat, and tears is completely, overlooked because you want to start the next movie or the next show, in the, but credits are very important, and can tell a great story, and you learn a lot about the process from reading about them.
Yeah, well, especially doing it the way that we're doing it, because we look at things and we say, oh, hey, what do what type of job does this person do and stuff like that, So yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I'm a firm believer. I always sit through the credits of a movie, and obviously, you're not able to grasp everything when you're sitting and watching it in the theater, stuff like that. But you catch bits and pieces here and there. I mean, you got to give a lot of credit to Marvel, the idea of adding. Little scenes in the middle and at the beginning and at the end. You never know where they're going to be, so you're sitting there watching the whole thing. Even you have movies like the extended editions of Lord of the Rings, where you have 30 or 40 minutes of credits because they list every person who was on
Right.
like the Lord of the Rings society or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the idea of credits. Also, like in older movies, up until George Lucas changed things, credits were always at the beginning of the movie, and they go by pretty super fast, and they were also truncated back then.
Yeah.
Most people who worked on the movie weren't even listed there. Nowadays, you have to list everybody who's on the movie, which is great. It's a great testament to that, and therefore the people who are there, they're gonna be sitting in the movie with a friend, say, hey, look, there's my name. There you go.
Right.
Just
Proved it. Proved
don't
it.
blink, you might
There I
miss it.
am. It's, I think it's like that separation, because obviously the first, among the first places where motion pictures were screened, in the early 20th century were theaters. They would pull down a screen and it would be, instead of a live show, or maybe sometimes even incorporated into a live show, you'd have a motion picture being shown. And so a lot of those, the crediting techniques, like the playbill that you would get for a show, a performance, a play, or a musical, it's clear that that is where Hollywood kind of first, that was their first start. It was like, okay, this is how we're going to credit the people involved. And the stars will be top billed, the director will get their big name, but if we are going to list any of this, the actual crew, it's going to be in the back, super small font, and just, just to say, yes, you helped. But then I think TV kind of threw another wrench in how credits are done. I've been watching over the last week or so, a lot of TV shows from the 50s and 60s, and they'd have an announcer come on. It's the Andy Griffith Show, starring Andy Griffith and, and Ron Howard, and they would just, make it almost like a play was being about to be put on. But then, like you said, George Lucas, I think he had to get special permission to make his movies
He had to get a special permission, yes.
to look as they did in the 30s, which was what he was trying to mimic.
I think he had to also
And
leave the Directors Guild because of that.
yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, that seemed to be something he was willing to do because of his art. What he was trying to accomplish overall was like, I'm trying to defy the studio system, the corporatization of, which of course is very coincidental now, or ironic, that his property is owned by the biggest corporation of them all.
That's right.
But with, you know, just bringing it back to this movie in this era, and this is essentially what, at least a component of what I do in my classroom and then also my podcast, and that is to treat things, including movies, as documents of time and place. And the credits, you know, whenever I lead a breakdown of a movie with my students or on my podcast, I always make sure to say, like, yes, we only have so much room to list, like, who the principal makers of this are. And I usually include, of course, the director, the writer, executive producer, and maybe some of the actors. Because sometimes, like this one, the movie was made around an actor or a character. But I say, if you really want to know how that movie was made, watch the credits. Because those are jobs. Every single person on there, big or small, had a job, big or small. It doesn't, you know, that without them, this movie would not have been made. That's how it was made, was this entire process. I think it's in this minute that we get to see the key grip. Is that one of the things listed there? Is that,
I have a feeling that's tomorrow, but well,
okay, I'll save that for then.
No, but it's really funny that you mentioned it. I mean, I've mentioned this probably in since we're on season seven, I've probably mentioned it in five of the seven seasons, or now will be the fifth time. My favorite movie that does the end credits properly is Lethal Weapon 4, where they have pictures of all of the people who worked on the film. You know, they have like all these group pictures as they're playing the song, you know, Why Can't We Be Friends? And it's great because they show all these production pictures, and it you know, it's nice seeing the list of names, but it's so much better to see the pictures of the people. And see what they're actually, you know, right. What they've, you know, these are the people that worked on this movie, and you know, the camaraderie and everything that goes on. I mean, if, you know, I recommend that anyone should just. I mean, it's a fun movie, and you know, it's one of the four best Lethal Weapon movies. But but again, they knew that they were ending the series at that point, and they decided, okay, we're gonna do something so special with the credits. And again, that just to me, it tears me up watching it, because you see, you know, you have all these people that are sitting that you have pictures of that spent months working together, or possibly years, depending if they were part of the whole franchise.
Right.
And you know, that's it. They're ending things. So
it's kind of like how when Jay Leno quit the Tonight Show the first time. Before he took it back from Conan. But when Jay Leno left the Tonight Show the first time, his farewell was very similar, in which he, and it was actually pretty emotional. I wasn't a regular watcher of the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, but I did like what he did. And that is, he had all of the families
right.
that had come to be because of the show, that people that worked on the show who met and, you know, got married and had and raised children together, came out with their kids, and he's like, yeah. If this is, you know, my legacy, then I'm proud of that. And, you know, it's such a great way to humanize, you know, the experience. Another movie that does that similar is Bend It Like Beckham, where they, at the end, show the behind the scenes, and you see, you know, cameramen goofing off, and, you know, people, you know, as like in between takes doing stuff, and it, I think that's, of course, it's obviously best at the end of the movie, where it's like, oh yeah, just a reminder, it's not a real story, and we're just, you know, making sure that you know, it's just a movie. You couldn't do it at the beginning. I saw a promo a few months ago for a TV show. I forget which one it was. One of like the emergency shows, like 911 or something, and they were doing like Instagram videos. Or that style of it was all the actors hamming it up on the set, and you know, saying our next season of this show is coming out soon, you know, make sure you watch. And I'm like, that kind of takes away from the believability of this show. I mean, it's not a comedy show. It's like, if you're already like, I know I'm not dumb that you are an actor and that you're not actually a fireman, but save it for the end, right? Save it for after I've watched for however long, and you know, at least give me some kind of credit that, you know, I remember that was a similar feeling I got when I was watching, you know, to bring it back, Alien 3. At the beginning, in the opening credits, and maybe they do this for the other two movies before it, but I don't remember it. In the opening credits, it says alien costume and, you know, special effects design, and it gives the credit to, I'm like, save that for the end. Like, get me interested in this movie. Like, kind of get me, like, you know, use this opening credits for, you know, to, you know, give me the exposition as much as possible, get, you know, set the scene. You know, I know you have to by law or by rule, you know, put the names of the principal players up, but I don't think you have to give the special effects guy credit in the opening scene. Like, I think you can wait for the puppeteer behind the dog alien thing to, you know, wait till the next credit scene at the end after we were done. So, you know,
right. Okay. But you got to do, you also do have to, you know, that's the type of movie that without that credit, the movie won't work at all. So maybe it was the idea that, okay, we're going to give them a little hat tip and put them there, you know.
Maybe that was...
Because everybody knows that it's special effects. You know, it's
not, maybe that was his deal.
You know, they're not spoiling that.
Maybe that's the deal that the guy made was, he's like, I get top billing, even before it's Sigourney Weaver. You know, I'm the guy.
Could be. You never know. All right, so we continue, you know, we go through the rest of the credits of the cast, and then it starts with the stuntmen and stuff like that. Did you count how many stuntmen are listed in this movie?
I did, and I mean, I recognized going into it, I'm like, there's going to be tons, you know, there's going to be a lot because it's the genre, right? It's how many did you count?
I counted 54.
That seems actually, okay. I don't know. I guess it's about right.
But what's really interesting though is when you look on IMDb. So IMDb has 58 people that are listed as credited in the stunt as a stunt team, and then they have another 26 that are uncredited.
Hmm.
You know, so basically, according to IMDb, there are 84 people who worked on the stunts in this movie, and that's amazing. That's a lot of people working on
that is
because this is a fun action movie, but you know, maybe a lot of these people are people that were working on Central Park that needed to like jump away from a car and stuff like that. You know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to give as a rationale for that is that there maybe became like for that day they were stuntmen. You know, it wasn't really their job or like what is defined as a stunt in Hollywood, right? Is it necessarily being on fire and running around or is it just jumping out of the way of a cat?
Exactly. Right?
Like, is it what qualifies?
I guess it depends on who, if they're paying your salary, saying that you are a, you know, that you are a paid stunt person or not. Maybe that's the criteria that they use here.
Yeah. Cause I'm guessing a lot of this has also to do with people building resumes, you know, so they get other work, other places. And they said, I was in this movie. And so, you know, maybe those 26 that aren't credited, like you said, were not career actors. They didn't really expect to ever go in, you know, do anything with it. So they just like, yeah, whatever. I can move slightly and, you know, fall down on the sidewalk or something.
Okay. No, but also I guess in the subway scene, you had to have, you had to have stunt people there also that are running away from the runaway train.
Yep.
So that sort of makes sense, I guess.
I need to ask, at what point, just remind me, at what point did this become a Die Hard movie? When did it go from being its own standalone picture to being incorporated into the Die Hard? Was it?
Well, based on my understanding, and again, it could be wrong because you know, I did this research a long time ago. You had Jonathan Hensley that wrote the, you know, the script Simon Says, and they were, you know, moving it around Hollywood. People saw it, and they're like, "This is a great idea, but we want to make it a blockbuster, so we're not going to, you know, let's connect it to a franchise." And the original idea was to connect it to Lethal Weapon. Which I've said numerous times over the season that I'm glad they didn't do that because it wouldn't have worked as well. Because one of the things that works perfectly in this movie is the chemistry between John and Zeus because they don't know each other. If you were to have Riggs and Murtaugh, it'd be a little different because, you sort of know them. they know each other, so it wouldn't be the same to do it that way. And so they were just playing around with different ideas, and then they came up with the idea that, hey, why don't you do this as a Die Hard movie? That's it.
So it, I mean, I guess that's why it does kind of, it was a smart move because I think if they'd made its own standalone movie, it would have completely been folded into all the other movies, just like it that came out in the mid 1990s. You know, these, even if it had a big star in it, it would have, but as a Die Hard movie, it works. And throughout the credits, we have the music when Johnny comes marching home again, which is used throughout the movie, which is just perfect because this is John McClane, you know, Johnny in his homecoming. You know, he comes back to New York. So I'm curious, you know, if it was Lethal Weapon, it wouldn't have been New York, but you know, it's something about New York City that it works really well, and I'm glad that they brought him to his home, you know, to do that. And it, you know, but that's why it doesn't feel the same as the other Die Hard movies. Not just the setting, but the pacing of it, and you know, having like little puzzles to solve kind of thing, you know, that and clues to follow. You know, it's kind of like Scream, the one surrounding it for similar reasons, where it's like a mystery that, you know, not just the normal Scooby-Doo style mystery that they have in the other movies, but you know, uncracking codes and analyzing photographs and doing that kind of stuff, and that's my favorite Scream movie because of that kind of thing. And you know, this is my favorite Die Hard movie because, you know, there is brawn. I mean, he uses a lot of his, you know, tough guy stuff to get things done, but there's also plenty of brains that need to be used to solve puzzles and
That's good.
stuff.
And again, I like the fact that they slightly tweak the formula throughout Die Hard. They keep the general formula, but they're slightly tweaking it to still keep things fun and interesting and unique with the way that they do it. So one of the things I always
Absolutely.
love doing when I look at credits is the fact that, usually there are groups of family members that usually work together in all these different types of categories and stuff like that. And it's very prevalent in the stunt coordination. So I saw two people with the same last name, so I checked into them, see if they're related. So you have Walter Scott and John Clay Scott. And it turns out that these guys are brothers. And Walt Scott, what shocked me
Okay.
was is I've actually he has, in my mind, two very prominent stunt roles that he's done over the course of his career. One of them was in the movie Hang 'Em High. He actually played he was he doubled for Clint Eastwood as he was hanging, by his neck. I don't know if you've seen Hang 'Em High or not. And
That's a heck of a stunt.
the second one is he's in Back to the Future. He's the guy driving the Jeep that Marty is hanging on to. And he looks back at him with like
With the
this
Mountain Dew
with the
hat,
Mountain Dew
yeah.
hat. Exactly. So yeah, I just thought that was fun to point out, along with it. So again, we go through all the stuntmen through the credits here, and then we start getting into the idea of the different production managers, and you get the first and second assistant directors. I mean, none of these people stood out for me, so I'm not gonna really go into any information about them. Then you have the visual effects supervisor, second unit director. I mean, again, these are the people that are running things, basically. These are the next level down from the director itself, that he's moving them, moving those chess pieces around the board, trying to make sure that everything gets done right here. And then the minute ends with a quick shot of the second unit director, and then it just like disappears as this minute ended. So did you have anything else you wanted to talk about in this minute?
No, I mean, I think you said it well just now with, you know, chess pieces on the board moving around. And I guess it just once again emphasizes how elaborate making a movie is. I mean, of course, the nature of this particular film would make it a tall order for anybody in any time period to make a movie like that. But any movie has credits that include a lot of these jobs. And people think about filmmaking as, it is a big operation. It's a gigantic industry, and it just 1 minute of underscores
Completely.
that.
All right. So obviously, at this point, I would talk about the script, but since we are in the credits, there is nothing to talk about in the script. Even though the non-existent script here is a little better than the script that we talked about, for the finale of the movie. Anyway, the original script. So today's segment is Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five movie trilogies. So I keep this a little flexible, the rules, you can sort of bend them a little bit. I've let everyone bend them a little bit, whichever direction you really want to. So would you start off with number five and work your way up?
Sure. And I think, just for the sake of this, and I think this is the kind of rule bending that you allow, is that I consider Die Hard as intended to be a trilogy. And so that would be number five for me. I think it fits in perfectly for there. Number five is the Die Hard trilogy. Number four, we were just talking about it, and that would be Back to the Future. Those movies, and what's interesting, especially about that one, and I would say a couple of them, is that they weren't necessarily intended to be trilogies. That they, it was the success of the first one that led to the next one and the one after that. And with Back
Sure.
to the Future, it
Everyone
was
thought Back to the Future was going to be a complete flop,
right. And just, and including the director, he's like, "Well, this is kind of silly. We're just gonna, let it happen this way." And then they really did have to scramble to make it, and then, but then they did the second two in a row. They filmed them simultaneously with
which
it,
was unheard
and
of up until then.
right. And then that became for a while the standard, and that's why, a lot of the trilogies that end up on lists are 21st century, because after a while they're just like, "We're gonna make a trilogy. We're gonna make a
That's
trilogy."
right.
Number three, I go back and forth with three and two, but
It's fine. It's what it is
I
today. It
kind of,
doesn't matter what it is tomorrow or what it was yesterday. It's what it is today.
yeah,
No one is saying
okay.
that this is what will be, written everywhere. That
Okay.
this is as of today.
Then I'm gonna throw a strange, curveball here. The Brady Bunch movie technically has three of them. It's the Brady Bunch movie, which came out the same year as Die Hard with a Vengeance, and then the Brady Bunch movie sequel, which came out the following year. And then 6 years goes by, and they make the Brady Bunch in the White House. So I'll put that on my list as
Wow,
well.
I gotta tell you, I don't know if you know
And
this or not, but you are not the first person this season on this list. The other person put it at their number one, which I don't necessarily agree with that one.
I it's the first movie in that trilogy. I don't have as much of a soft spot for the second one, but the first one of my all-time favorite movies. It's so well done. And I guess I'm surprised happily, but not totally surprised, because I'm assuming that, we were probably around the same age and watching movies, and they all came out the same time period. So they might have some, and another movie that was on HBO and Showtime all the time during the summer. So that's another reason why. The Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy would be number two for me. Those are just fantastic. And I kind of am not the usual person when it comes to those, because I still think Batman Begins, that's my favorite of the trilogy. And most people like Dark Knight is great, but I think Batman Begins is the superior movie of the three. But that'd be my number two. And number one, it's cliche, but Star Wars, the original trilogy is,
I don't think I've ever heard of that movie.
yeah,
What happens
it's
there?
like a space opera thing. There's like a big gorilla type character and a guy with a light sword. But you should look into it. I think you'd like it.
I'll have to look into it. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that, Eric. Would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Sure. The easiest place would be everything-history.com. That's the Everything is a Primary Source hub, because it's not just a podcast. Like I said before, it's my teaching method. It's my project. It's where we treat popular culture, artifacts of everyday life. I had somebody refer to it really well one time as cultural debris. And we hold these things up like you would items in a museum. We analyze them, we talk about them, and see how think Die Hard or the Brady Bunch movie or television shows, books, of course, all sorts of different pop media, and how that informs us about different time periods. So everything-history.com. And when it comes to social media, Everything is a Primary Source. That's the name of the podcast. It's also where on Instagram, that's where I hang out the most. And I try to, if not daily, at least a few times a week, put up pop culture, history through pop culture posts. So that's where to start. It would be everything-history.com.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to any podcast from using this listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for A Movie a Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can also find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieofminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movieofminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Marching home again, hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.